And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday afternoon. Well, the George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin confrontation in Sanford, Florida, was just a bit more than 2 years ago. It created legal and emotional turmoil and dominated the nation's news and talk cycles. This hour, we go into great detail about the case with Today Show and NBC legal analyst attorney Lisa Bloom. She covered the Zimmerman trial, has reviewed every minute of its transcripts. She's written Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. And Lisa Bloom joins us now from Los Angeles via Skype. Good morning to you, Lisa.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And it's good to have you. Lisa, before we look at your examination of the George Zimmerman trial, do you have an opinion on the future of Stand Your Ground, and especially in Florida, especially on the heels of Michael Dunn's shooting of Jordan Davis?
Well, what I'm seeing is a tremendous outcry against Stand Your Ground, especially from the African-American community. And, you know, I review it extensively in my book. We were a nation that did not have any Stand Your Ground laws prior to a few years ago. Now so many people feel that it's a fundamental right, but for 250 years, I think we did much better without Stand Your Ground. I think we did better requiring people to retreat safely from a violent encounter rather than responding with gunfire. Stand Your Ground eliminated that and allows people to shoot when they feel threatened. I think it's a terrible law. I think it promotes violence. I think ultimately it's going to be repealed, but it may be a very long time before that happens.
Now, the Zimmerman-Martin incident was first a local incident, and the Sanford police said Stand Your Ground law kept them from arresting Zimmerman. Then the pressure changed that, correct?
Well, that's right. So the reason why so many in law enforcement and so many prosecutors oppose Stand Your Ground is because it does make life more difficult for them in prosecuting a shooter. Most people are aware that self-defense is a complete defense to a shooting. So when they're caught gun in hand or later on and found to have shot someone, of course they're going to say, I shot in self-defense. And when the other person is deceased, it's very difficult to prove that. I mean, certainly police can and do investigate these cases, but it's much more difficult when Stand Your Ground increases the rights of people to shoot. And that's what happened here. So it was 45 days before George Zimmerman was even arrested. Meanwhile, Trayvon's family was, you know, very upset and discouraged. From their perspective, our 17-year-old son and family member was just walking back from the 7-Eleven with candy and a fruit drink. He was shot and killed. You know who the shooter is. What's taking so long?
I found it very interesting, Lisa, that in the press material for our interview today, the subtitle is not what's on the book, but it's the inside story of the Trayvon Martin trial. Was that just an oversight, or do you feel that's what happened, that Trayvon Martin was the one put on trial?
So I'm not sure what you have, but the book title is Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it.
Right.
I prefer to call it the Trayvon Martin trial. Of course, officially, legally, it was the George Zimmerman trial. But I think Trayvon Martin got lost in that trial. He wasn't humanized. One of my criticisms of the prosecution, among many, as you know from the book, is that they referred to Trayvon Martin as a victim in closing arguments and throughout the case. Instead of calling him by his name, instead of breathing life into this young man, as prosecutors typically do in murder cases, you know, the jury needed to understand a little bit about who he was. And yes, they're constrained by the rules from doing too much of that, but they could have done more than they did.
Did you find out more about Trayvon Martin, the person, through your interviews for this book?
After the trial.
Yes.
I did a little bit. I was fascinated, for example, that his family nickname was Mouse, and that's because he was a quiet young man. I found from Rachel Gentile, the young woman who testified in the case, who was his friend on the phone with him at the time, just before his encounter with George Zimmerman, at the first moments when he met George Zimmerman. Rachel Gentile talked about Trayvon as a very funny person. Her favorite characteristic of him was that he was always joking and teasing. And in fact, even on that call, even after he first saw Zimmerman following him and staring at him, He was initially concerned and afraid. Then when Zimmerman disappeared briefly, he returned to this jokey, funny way, teasing her about her obsession with doing her hair. And, you know, I thought that got lost in the trial as well. The prosecutors didn't, you know, they kind of got stuck in the weeds instead of bringing out this much larger, more important theme, which was that Trayvon Martin was happy that day. He was joking around. He wanted to watch the basketball game. He wanted to keep chatting on the phone with his teenage friend. That tone got completely lost, and instead the defense was able to portray Trayvon Martin as a homicidal maniac waiting to jump out of the bushes and kill George Zimmerman.
Of course, they also had some of the social media of Trayvon Martin's pictures, and even brought up Trayvon's school suspensions and to kind of sully his reputation.
And I talk about those school suspensions at some length in the second half of the book, because that is something I hear from the Zimmerman defenders fairly often. Well, he was a thug, which I think is code for the new N-word, frankly. But they call him a thug and a delinquent because he had been suspended three times. It's true that he was suspended three times in the 6 months before the shooting. What people are not aware of is how common suspensions now are in school. You know, older people like me, we think of somebody suspended as that's a really big deal. In today's world, suspensions have skyrocketed. And so his first offense was tardiness to a class. We're suspending children, especially African-American boys, for very minor offenses that used to result in detention, more school, maybe a trip to the principal's office. You know, now they're kept out of school. It's, in my opinion, a terrible phenomenon. There are lawsuits going on in Florida by the NAACP and other civil rights organizations about the disparate impact, especially on African-American boys. Many people feel it's one of the primary reasons why we have such a high dropout rate among African-American boys, because they're constantly pushed out of school, being suspended for very minor offenses.
Are you saying in the same school a white student wouldn't be suspended for tardiness while an African-American one would?
I am saying that. And in my book, I go through, in fact, Trayvon's high school, the actual school rules that govern what discipline a child gets for different behaviors. And they have, I think, five levels of discipline, which is appropriate. You don't want to discipline somebody the same way if they're, for example, late for a class versus, you know, they punch someone in the face, right? So the lowest level is supposed to result in counseling, a call to the parents, a conference with the child, and the highest level is expulsion, and there's a, you know, graduated disciplinary system. I go through what Trayvon Martin's offenses were and the punishments that he got, those three suspensions, and they are not in keeping with the school's own rules. And that's exactly what the NAACP and others in Florida have been saying. And this is very consistent with what we see in the criminal justice system, that certain behavior by African Americans is considered more threatening than the same behavior engaged in by white people, shoving somebody, for example. And African Americans in the criminal justice system are punished far more harshly, and it's very similar to what happens in schools.
Back to Trayvon, one was for tardiness. What were the other two reasons?
The second one was for writing on a locker. He wrote three letters on a locker, WTF. And the third one was
for... We all know what that stands for.
Right. And the third one was for having a baggie in his backpack with marijuana residue. So I think, you know, certainly all three of these offenses are a problem and are worthy of discussion and are worthy of some discipline. That's not the question. The question is, should he have been suspended for 1 day, 3 days, and then 10 days for these offenses? You know, most educators think kids like this need more school, not less school. And many kids who are suspended are simply sent home to an empty house or left to wander on the streets. You know, we're supposed to be educating children and bringing them into the fold and helping them rather than just pushing them out.
Did you speak to officials at his school? Did you interview any of them?
I did not interview any of the school officials. I did, as I say, I got a hold of their school rules, which are in writing, which is supposed to govern their behavior.
Well, we're going to take a break, but before we do, I just want to say I want to get to the heart of the book, and that's about the state of Florida, you say, bungled the case from prosecutor to closing arguments to judge and the six big mistakes. But we need to take that break. We're speaking with Lisa Bloom. She's a civil rights attorney, journalist, legal analyst, and author. And her latest book is Suspicion Nation, The Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice and Why We Continue to Repeat It. We'll be back.
And we return 19 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and NBC legal analyst and attorney Lisa Bloom. Her latest book is Suspicion Nation, The Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice and Why We Continue to Repeat It. Lisa covered the Zimmerman trial and has gone over the transcript of the trial as well. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org, and Facebook,
Twitter.
Twitter, of course.
Is at Topical Currents. So getting to these mistakes, Lisa, let's look at them, beginning with your claim that the prosecution ignored its best evidence and its smoking gun. What was that?
That was that George Zimmerman was on videotape the day after the shooting, demonstrating the incident to the police to some extent. And he demonstrated that where his gun was holstered, it was holstered, according to Zimmerman, behind him inside the waistband of his pants, covered by his shirt and his jacket. He demonstrated this in a standing position. I have the photograph from that video in my book. And the police never asked him to get down on his back to demonstrate the most important part of the altercation, which is just before the shooting. Zimmerman says he was on his back. Trayvon Martin was straddling him, knees to elbows. Trayvon Martin saw the gun, reached for the gun, and threatened to kill Zimmerman, and that's when he had to pull the gun and shoot in self-defense, he says. Well, the gun in that position behind Zimmerman would not have been visible to Trayvon Martin in that position. Unless Trayvon Martin had X-ray vision, he could not have seen through the bulk of Zimmerman's body. And when you add to that, it was an extremely dark night, according to all of the witnesses. It was raining, and there was a grassy ground cover. George Zimmerman's story on that point would have been completely undercut. Throughout the trial, the prosecution neglected to point this out. Not in opening statements, not on the cross-examination of any witnesses. And in fact, the defense padded the front of their body, the attorneys did, in demonstrating where the gun was. That was incorrect. I have that picture in my book as well. And the prosecution never objected to that. You know, after some of us started talking about this on television a lot the last week of the trial, at the very end of the trial and closing argument, the prosecution mentioned this for the first time, just mentioned briefly this point, which should have been really driven home by using the video, by putting all of these facts together. Most attorneys would have really driven this home, beginning and ending with the point, lying down in the courtroom, putting the gun in one's own pants, lying down on one's own back, turning down the lights in the courtroom, and really driving home to the jury how this critical moment in the self-defense story would not have been possible. The prosecution failed to do that.
Let me ask you, we'll get to some of the other things that were mishandled in your book, the other blunders, but why do you think they did miss so much with the whole world watching, especially the United States? Do you think they had motives?
Right. So, Bonnie, that's the critical question that I asked myself in writing this book. Did they blow it or throw it? Right. And I'm going to leave it to my readers to come to their own conclusions after I go through these very significant mistakes that were made in the case. Ultimately, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't want to accuse people of intentionally bungling a case unless I have some pretty strong evidence for that, which I don't have. I do think most courtroom lawyers, including these prosecutors, do want to win their case once they're in the courtroom. But these mistakes were very significant, many of them rookie mistakes. For example, failing to put together a theory of the case to give to the jury in closing arguments, simply asking the jury questions in closing arguments, raising reasonable doubt, really, right alongside the defense. I mean, there's not a prosecutor in the world who would recommend that strategy. The jury is not going to come up with its own theory of the case. They're not going to do the prosecution's job for them. So my conclusion in the book is that the prosecution did not believe in the case. Remember, they never wanted this case to begin with. It was really foisted upon them by the groundswell of public outcry for 45 days that caused Zimmerman ultimately to get arrested. But that same public outcry couldn't get into the attorneys' offices and get them to prepare the case in the way that attorneys do when they really believe in the case. Couldn't get them to review the evidence over and over. Couldn't get them to bring into the case expert witnesses who, I talk in the book about an expert witness who had a scientific theory he wanted to offer but was not allowed to. You just can't get people to believe in a case that they don't believe in. And I think ultimately that was what the problem was here.
Refresh us on jury composition and selection for the trial.
Sure. So this was a six-person jury, which is an unusual feature that Florida has. A few other states do, but most states have 12-person juries. Florida has 12-person juries only on first-degree murder cases. So this was second-degree murder. There were 12 jurors. Just by happenstance, they all ended up being female.
You mean six?
I'm sorry, six jurors.
Yeah.
Five of the jurors were white women. And the sixth is a juror named Maddie, who I profile in the book, and she was a Puerto Rican woman. She also says African-American people are my culture. And, you know, it is intriguing to me when I was covering the case, I was told by my network to say that the sixth juror was Hispanic or African-American because we didn't know. And I said, well, Hispanic or African-American or both, maybe. Ultimately, I was a little confused. Ultimately, when I sat down and spoke with her, I asked her, you know, what box do you check off when you have to identify your race? And she said, you know, I never really thought of myself as a minority. I never really thought about it. I guess Puerto Rican. But then when she talks about African Americans, she says they're my culture and my people. So a lot of people don't like being categorized, and Maddie is one of them.
Let's take a couple of telephone calls, Lisa. This is Michael in Miami Beach. Hi. Michael, you're up. And he just dropped off. Let's go to Robert. He's in Miami. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I'm very much enjoying the program. I'm in my mid-40s. I'm white, and I'm a principal of a middle school. And I had an experience I just wanted to share, maybe get your comments on. About 3 weeks ago, I was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had come home from work and I went out for a run. And as I was walking back to my house in my condo association, we've had 31 robberies in the last 10 months. We've been to the homeowners association, had the police come in. We've identified the person as Hispanic or black who wears a hoodie, and we've yet to catch them. So I'm on the homeowners association, by the way. So I come through the park and I'm walking down towards the street. A black teenager is approaching me, and he's wearing a hoodie on his head, and I'm walking by, and you know, I've had a busy day, I got a lot on my mind, and I walked by and I looked up and I saw him and I said, "Hey man, how you doing?" And he looked at me and said, "Pretty good, how are you?" And I continued to walk, you know, past him. And I got about 15 steps and I thought to myself, "Wow, that was it right there. That was the circumstance." And I guess we just all have different reactions in different circumstances, and I just think it's sad the way the whole thing turned out. Thanks.
Hmm. Okay, thank you for calling. Lisa?
So that's an interesting call to me. And, you know, I call the book Suspicion Nation because ultimately I think the root of the George Zimmerman case and the root of so many cases is our suspicions and our fears of our neighbors, and in particular, African-American males. You know, let's be honest, that is one of the oldest and most pernicious stereotypes that still exists in our culture. So George Zimmerman, when he was telling the story of that night to the police and other occasions when he was asked about it, he always began with, "There have been a lot of burglaries in my neighborhood." And the defense in the case said that Trayvon Martin was a match, that was their word, match, to the burglars. Well, it turned out that Trayvon Martin was a match to those burglars really only because of race. The burglars, in fact, in that case, were about 10 years older than him. And we had never learned that the burglars in that case wore a hoodie or were walking slowly in the rain, talking on the phone as Trayvon Martin was, or any height, weight, or other characteristics. It was simply race. And one of my criticisms of the prosecution in this case is they failed to object to testimony about these African-American burglars who had nothing to do with Trayvon Martin. They shared only skin color. And to attribute the wrongs of two African-Americans to all African-Americans is the very definition of racism. And it's, I think, a big part of the reason why the African-American community has responded with such pain to this case, to the idea that everyone is suspicious merely walking down the street if they have dark skin, that their community is constantly viewed as criminal, even when, of course, the majority of the community are not criminals. And, you know, I really tried to drill down on this issue in the book, looking at the numbers, because, you know, liberals, progressives even will say to me, okay, you know, I agree with what you're saying, Lisa, but isn't it true that African Americans do commit a disproportionate amount of crime? And isn't it appropriate for me to be afraid of a young black kid walking down the street? And so I really looked at the numbers, everything that was available in terms of crime statistics. And the answer is no, it's not appropriate. If you're white, you are far more likely to be victimized by another white person, because most crime is intra-racial, meaning white on white, black on black. If my home is burglarized, for example, it's far more, about six times as likely that it's gonna be by a white person. So those are the actual numbers, and I really tried to look very carefully at this black male as criminal stereotype, which goes back to the days of slavery, through the Jim Crow era, through a lot of social scientists, really putting this out as propaganda to justify discrimination against African Americans 50 years ago in America. And I hope that this is a stereotype that we can put to rest, that we can put behind us, because it's causing us a lot of damage, I think, and really impeding our ability to become the egalitarian people we want to be.
Well, I guess this is the time to bring up, you cite this implicit racial bias as the cause of the repetition of the racial profiling in this case and rampant in the criminal justice system. So explain what that is and where one can actually take that test.
Mm-hmm. So I'm so glad to talk about implicit racial bias, because I also think this is the key. So most of us would say we are not racist, right? Very few people in America, you know, claim to be racist anymore. Maybe skinheads, white supremacists, but those are extremists. Most of us, in fact, are very confident that we're not racist, right? Most people say, I don't see color. You know, maybe that guy in that news story is a racist, but boy, I sure am not. Well, it turns out.
Or it's institutional sometimes, probably.
Right, right. And so, and yet, you know, as I talk about in the book, there's so much discrimination that still occurs, especially in the criminal justice system, but also in jobs, for example, where there are a lot, there's studies about white men with a felony record get the job over a black man without a criminal record when everything else in the resume is the same, right? So we see that kind of thing happening over and over again. Well, how is that possible if we all claim not to be racist? So psychologists have developed a very clever tool called the implicit racial bias test, developed by Harvard University researchers, which you can take online for free. It takes about 15 minutes. And you're probably going to be very disturbed at what you find, because about 80% of white people test for moderate or severe racial bias. And perhaps most saddening of all is the fact that about 50% of African Americans test for racial bias against African Americans. You can't cheat the test. I don't want to give too much away, but I do encourage everyone to take it. And I took it. And listen, I've been a civil rights lawyer for almost 30 years. I have biracial children. I've really been in the trenches of the issues of race and gender in our culture. I was very confident that I was going to do just fine on the implicit racial bias test. And I talk about my experience taking the test in the book. And guess what? I didn't do so well. Mm-hmm. I thought surely this was a mistake. With a certain amount of arrogance, I guess, right, on my part. I took it again, the same result. And so I really had to think long and hard about how racial biases really are so entrenched in our culture. Listen, children as young as 6 years old, African-American children, when they're shown a white doll and a black doll and they're asked, which one is the good doll? They point to the white doll. Which one is the evil doll? They point to the black doll. Children as young as 6 years old have already absorbed these messages. So I guess it shouldn't be surprising that people my age, 52, also really have a lot of work to do. The good news is we can overcome it. There are relatively easy ways to overcome racial bias, but I think it's a lifelong process. And I have some hopeful information in the book as well about doctors and police and judges who are able to talk to people about how to overcome racial bias. And I think it's a job we all need to do.
What is that website? We'll have a link to it on our website along with your book.
Okay, let me.
Do you know it? You get that. We're going to take a break,
okay?
Okay, and
okay,
when we
sure.
come back, we're talking to Lisa Bloom. She is a civil rights attorney. And her latest book is Suspicion Nation, The Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice. We will be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. We resume our conversation with attorney and legal analyst Lisa Bloom about her book, Suspicion Nation, which covers the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin confrontation in Sanford, Florida.
And you're going to go to a call, but before...
Okay. Oh, yeah, the
website.
I have it. So it's implicit.harvard.edu. And you can test your social attitudes about race, also about gender and sexual orientation, and you may be surprised.
So it's implicit.harvard.edu.
Right.
Okay, we'll have a link to that.
And we'll have that on our Facebook page. Let's go to Juan. He's in Tamarack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question for our guest. What laws exist in Florida that may protect an individual who's trying to, in place of the Stand Your Ground law, that would allow, let's say, for example, me defend myself if someone's attacking me at the time or is, you know, raping my daughter or something, and I need to incapacitate that individual? If
sure.
there was no Stand Your Ground law, is there something else that protects me if in the process I hurt the individual to stop them?
Sure. So we have all always had the right to defend ourselves or to defend others. Before Stand Your Ground, that was the case, and that's still the case. That's a fundamental right of self-defense. The law prior to Stand Your Ground required a person to retreat safely from a violent altercation if that was possible. So, for example, in the Michael Dunn case, the Loud Music murder trial, he got in his car to get the gun that he used to shoot into the vehicle with the four young people. Prior to Stand Your Ground, he would have been required, when he got into that car, to drive off because he could have safely retreated. That is the portion of the law that was changed by Stand Your Ground. Now, even if there's an opportunity for safe retreat, citizens are not required to take it. You can pull up the gun and shoot in self-defense. But as I point out in the book, there are still a couple of really important factors that should have been emphasized by the prosecutors in the Zimmerman case that weren't. And that is, you have to be in reasonable fear of imminent great bodily injury or death. Because while, of course, we want everyone to be able to save their own lives, we want that to be exercised very carefully. We don't want people in an ordinary fist fight, for example, to pull out a gun and shoot to kill the other person. We don't want someone who's merely suffering from humiliation or scrapes and bruises to pull out a gun and shoot another person. A person really has to be in reasonable fear of imminent great bodily injury or death. And most prosecutors would emphasize those three elements in closing arguments in a self-defense case. They didn't do that in the Trayvon Martin case. And
that's
so George Zimmerman, for example, said he was panicked. Panic is not reasonable.
I think that's pretty interesting, because if it requires you to be in panic and fear, but at the same time you're able to leave the scenario, I mean, how much fear can you really have if you can leave?
Well,
I guess in the Stand Your Ground, you know, defense.
Right. Well, I mean, listen, it's all about valuing human life, because in many situations, someone is in fear, and perhaps the fear wasn't reasonable in retrospect. You know, after the shooting, it turns out to be a tragic mistake. And so prior to Stand Your Ground, the law was trying to avoid that kind of situation and to value human life. A person was required to retreat only if they could do so safely. So if you're George Zimmerman said he was pinned down by Trayvon Martin. That's why it really wasn't a Stand Your Ground case, because according to his story, there was no opportunity to retreat. And that's why he didn't ask for a hearing before the trial on Stand Your Ground law, which he could have done.
Just to be clear, if I were to defend myself and someone and the perpetrator gets hurt in the process because I had no choice, I had to defend myself, they don't really have a legal recourse as it were before this, right?
Well, you know, again, it depends on the facts of the case. If you're going to use deadly force, you have to be in reasonable fear of imminent great bodily injury or death, right? Because we want to be very, very careful in allowing people to use lethal force against another citizen.
Tell me, Lisa Bloom, for those who were ardent supporters of George Zimmerman during the trial, I wonder what the reaction is in the post-trial behavior of Zimmerman, the scrapes he's been in and the firearms. And
right. So, right, as
domestic
we've seen in,
disputes.
Right. So twice since the trial's been over, George Zimmerman has been accused of pointing a gun in the face of an intimate partner, his wife, now his ex-wife, and his girlfriend, right at the time when they were asking him to leave, which I think is very interesting. Both of them have refused to file charges, and the second one recanted. So it's a murky situation, but the stories are remarkably similar. And, you know, when you put together what happened in the Trayvon Martin case, as I do in the book, George Zimmerman was mostly concerned that Trayvon Martin not get away before the police arrived. He had had prior experiences calling the police on African-American men in the neighborhood, none of whom had been convicted of any crimes, parenthetically, but they had gotten away, and so his frustration had increased. And by February 26, 2012, he did not want Trayvon Martin to get away. He said on the phone to the police, on the recorded call, I'll skip the profanity, but these guys always get away. He used a lot of profanity referring to Trayvon Martin. So he wanted him to stay. And the theory of the case that I have in my alternative closing argument that I put in the book is that he probably drew the gun early on in the altercation to keep Trayvon Martin in place, to keep him from getting away. Very similar to the ways these two women afterwards accused him to pulling the gun on them when they're trying to get him to leave and he didn't want to leave. That's my theory of the case.
Do you think there's, I know you're not a psychologist, but do you think there's an underlying reason for his behavior since the acquittal related to the acquittal?
Listen, I think George Zimmerman has an anger management problem. He had two incidents in 2005, which did not come into the trial, but one of them was shoving a police officer, and another one was his then fiance getting a restraining order against him at the time that they were breaking up. He then filed for a restraining order against her. And then we had these two incidents after the trial. I think that's the root of the problem. Most killings in America happen for this mundane, old reason, and that is just anger. People are angry. And I think that's what happened in this case. You know, you have a through line of the way George Zimmerman thought about Trayvon Martin, these punks, these a-holes, these, you know, and the profanity that he used from the moment he set eyes on the young man who he had never met before, calling him a suspect immediately after the shooting, and then 5 months later saying the killing was God's plan. So, I mean, he had this anger towards this teenager that he'd never met before that carried all the way through, even months later when his attorney is sitting beside him and he'd had time to think about it. It's really extraordinary to me.
How much of the problem do you attribute to guns and what you call the lax gun laws in the country, not just the stand your ground law, but guns themselves?
You know, many people think that more guns makes us safer. And if that were true, we would be the safest country in the world because we have more guns per capita than any other country in the world by far. Number two is Yemen, and we have about double the number per capita as Yemen. And the fact is that we have the number one highest number of gun shootings in the developed world. So more guns clearly is not making us safer. Listen, I think there's a big difference between having a gun in your home for protection, as many people do, and carrying a concealed weapon around on the street when you're going to Target, as George Zimmerman did, without proper safety training, without licensing. I think at a minimum, many people in the NRA, for example, feel that gun safety is important. And I think one thing people on both sides of the gun issue can agree upon is on background checks, on gun safety training, and keeping guns out of the hands of people who have anger management problems or mental illness or felony convictions. When I say we have such lax gun laws, that's what I'm referring to. There are countries that have a fair amount of guns, not nearly as many as we do, but countries like Israel or Switzerland, relative to Europe and the West, they have a lot of guns, and they have a relatively low amount of gun violence because of their safety and training requirements. And that's something I would like to see in our country.
Well, as an addendum, can the neighborhood watch captain carry a gun in Sanford, Florida?
Right, not anymore. That's a law that was changed after this case.
We're speaking with Lisa Bloom. She's a civil rights attorney, journalist, legal analyst, and author. And her latest book is Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, along with legal analyst and attorney Lisa Bloom. We're talking about her book, Suspicion Nation. Well, we have a lot of people on the phone board. Let's go to Joe in Coral Springs. Hi.
Hi. Hello. Bonnie, Joseph, and Ms. Bloom. I'm a WLR and supporter and listen every day. I have a quick question. Shortly after the news broke of the unfortunate incident between George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, Channel 7 ran a news story which actually had a dramatization, and the news story went that Trayvon was suspended from school for graffiti, and when the school searched his backpack for the magic marker and the pen that he used for the graffiti, they found gold chains, a watch, a large screwdriver, and like a burglar bar, which he had stated that he was holding for a friend. And that news story like never ran again, which I found strange because it was like right after the unfortunate incident. And I guess my question is, if the tables had been turned and Trayvon had hold of the gun and killed George Zimmerman, would he have been protected by stand your ground law? And then I guess my statement would be, as far as young black males and their surrounding their elders, in words of Bill Cosby, to respect your elders, and would that have stopped the loud music shooting that was in North Florida?
Let's let Ms. Bloom comment, especially on your first two questions.
Okay, thank you. So with regard to the burglary tool, this is the first I've ever heard about a burglary bar. Some have referred to a screwdriver that was allegedly in Trayvon's backpack. This is months before the incident as a burglary tool. Of course, screwdrivers have many uses other than burglary tools. I myself own a screwdriver. I'm not a burglar. So the incident with the jewelry in his backpack, his parents have always said they were never told about that. There was never any criminal conviction or even a victim who said, that's my jewelry that was robbed by Trayvon Martin. So it's kind of an ambiguous fact in the case. It was reported that there was this incident where he had women's jewelry in his backpack, but I don't know what to make of it because it's kind of a murky situation factually. And again, all of this, of course, was months before the incident, and George Zimmerman certainly didn't know anything about it. So, you know, I don't know what to say about it other than that.
And his second point was, wasn't it that if he had...
Well, if the tables were turned.
If the tables were turned.
Trayvon had shot Zimmerman.
Could he have claimed stand your ground? That was
yes.
his question.
Listen, we know from Rachel Gentile, who was the young woman speaking to Trayvon on the phone, and I go through her testimony and her story in depth in the book, Suspicion Nation. We know from Rachel Gentile that Trayvon Martin was initially afraid of George Zimmerman. He referred to him as creepy, and she speculated and said to Trayvon, maybe he's a rapist in the way that, you know, young people are concerned that there's an older man following a teenager around, staring at them. That's something that goes through their minds, right? So he was concerned. He was afraid. Then Zimmerman disappeared. Then they were back to joking. Then Zimmerman reappeared. And Rachel Gentile said she heard on the phone Trayvon Martin say, why are you following me? Which is a perfectly appropriate question in my view. And Zimmerman said, according to Rachel, what are you doing around here? Then she heard a thump on Trayvon's chest, and she heard Trayvon say, get off, get off. So if that is all accurate, it adds up to Zimmerman being the aggressor. And indeed, Trayvon Martin would have the right to stand his ground, to punch Zimmerman, to get him off of him, or to do whatever is necessary to defend himself. And, you know, what often got lost in this story was Trayvon Martin's right to defend his ground. But I think the bigger issue is that we know that there's a very clear racial bias in self-defense and stand your ground cases, where a white person who attacks a black person is far more likely to be acquitted on a stand your ground case. In fact, they're likely to not even be charged, versus the other way around. An African-American is far more likely to be convicted if they attack or kill a white person. I mean, those statistics have been shown over and over again by a variety of studies.
I just want to ask you, because you make it clear you don't blame the jury for Zimmerman's acquittal, but with the same jury, do you believe that a more competent prosecution could have won this case?
Right. So you're absolutely right. I blame the professionals, not the amateurs, and that's what jurors are. They're just regular people conscripted into service. I tell Maddie's story in the first chapter of the book because I was so taken by how distraught she remains to this day. She feels, she says, as though the death of Trayvon Martin weighs on her shoulders. She felt Zimmerman was guilty of murder. She said 4 out of the 6 went into deliberations, even after this very weak job by the prosecution. They went in wanting to convict, but they didn't have the facts and the evidence to do so. And so they did what they were instructed to do, which is to acquit, because they didn't have the facts and the law to justify their position. The problem, in my view, is this was a very winnable case, and the prosecution didn't give the roadmap to conviction that they could have given them. You know, having said that, can I say to a certainty 100% that the jury would have convicted Zimmerman if the prosecution had not made all these mistakes? No, of course I can't say that. But I can say that there were 4 out of the 6 voices for conviction going into deliberations. They were hungry for the facts and the law, and they just were not provided to them, so that the 2 very strong voices for acquittal ultimately prevailed.
Mm-hmm. And we'll take some more calls. We are getting short on time. I ask our callers to be brief. Justin, Dania Beach, hi.
Hi. I have a question and a comment. First, I'm calling about a story that came on about 2 months ago on the news. It was a teenager was a victim of a practical joke, had his clothes stolen, and was walking, trying to walk home naked on Hollywood Boulevard. And he was shot and killed by a man who pulled over, claiming he was pulling over to help him. And I know that you don't know the specifics of this particular case, but I'm just wondering how many other cases out there are like this that are just not becoming in the national spotlight. And my comment is, growing up, I always heard stories from my father, who grew up in the years of civil rights struggle, and they were horror stories about the way people were treated and all the racial violence. And it's just a real shame that now I'm going to have to tell my kids those same stories from when I was growing up. Mm. And that's it. I'll take my comment, my answer.
Thank you for calling.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for that. And I don't know the particulars of that story. It's very sad. Certainly people of every race in America are shot in horrifying tragedies every day. I don't remember the exact number, it's in the book, but I think American children are something like 20 times more likely to die from gun violence in America than in other developed countries. I mean, this is something we just allow to happen, mostly with a shrug. And gun violence, you know, sees no color. Having said that, there are a series of cases of unarmed African-American young people shot by white people who were afraid of them, who turned out to be wrong after the shooting, that we're seeing in the news over and over again. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, John Spooner shot a 13-year-old boy, Darius Simmons, who's African-American, thinking he was a burglar. The kid was just a neighbor taking out the trash. We see, of course, the Trayvon Martin case. 8 months after Trayvon Martin, Jonathan Farrell in Charlotte, North Carolina, crashed his car. Somebody called the police to help. When the police arrived, Farrell ran with his arms up towards the police. He was shot and killed. In Dearborn Heights, Michigan, Renisha McBride's car broke down. She knocked on a door trying to get help. The white homeowner opened the door, put a shotgun in her face, and shot and killed her. So, I mean, we're seeing these stories recurring over and over again, and that's why the second half of my book is about why. These are not one-off cases, sadly, and I agree with the pain in that caller's voice when he says, I have to talk to my children about civil rights still. We do have to talk about it. Our kids, by the way, are well aware of these stories, and especially African-American boys are very concerned. You know, am I next? Am I walking too slowly, like Trayvon Martin was? Am I walking too fast, like other young people? You know, what is the right speed for a young black male to be walking in America so he won't be considered suspicious? I think we have to talk about these stories. That's why I wrote the book. And ultimately, the only way to get past these terribly painful stories is to talk about them and to raise consciousness and to effect change.
Tell us, we only have about 45 seconds, but you know, you have this background as a civil rights attorney. Tell us a little about that and how you got involved and why you followed that path.
Well, I've been a civil rights lawyer since 1986. I still have a practice in Los Angeles and New York. I always knew that I wanted to fight for the underdog against, you know, the big corporate America type defendants. I just find that more challenging, more interesting, and I always wanted to do cases I believe in. I've had the great privilege of doing a lot of television commentary on these cases. They're very meaningful to me. What can I tell you? This is what I love to do. I'm a lawyer, and I wanted to fight for people whose cases matter.
Well, we thank you very much.
We do thank you. Lisa Bloom is a civil rights attorney, journalist, legal analyst, author. She's covered trials for CNN, The Today Show, and MSNBC for the last 20 years. And her latest book is Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. And we'll have a link to the book and to that test, which is implicit.harvard.edu, on our website and on our Facebook page. Thank you, Lisa Bloom, very much.
Thank you so much, Joseph and Bonnie. I love to hear from everybody on Twitter, at Lisa Bloom. Let me know your thoughts.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on here. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. We always have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well, including today's book link, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program honors Women's History Month. We begin with two septarians who made huge impacts on the community. Also, Linda Gastenheimer and Fred Tasker. The subject is beer and food. Now the calendar. On this day in 1770, 244 years ago, the Boston Massacre erupts. Five Americans die after baiting British soldiers. The Redcoats were tried and acquitted, defended by John Adams. And on this day in 1963, 51 years ago, the death of country music's greatest female singer, 31-year-old Patsy Cline, in an airplane crash in Tennessee. Willie Nelson wrote her greatest hit, Crazy. One more while we're not ready for prime time. On this day in 1982, 32 years ago, the death of comedian John Belushi of a drug overdose in West Hollywood, California. He was of Albanian descent. We leave with a thought from Patsy Cline, whose dream house had gold dust sprinkled into the bathroom tile. Quote, "I got a 12-year-old girl who plays steel guitar out of this world. She also plays a sax and sings. Looks like a blonde doll. Her name is Barbara Mandrell." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay tuned. Here and now, next from NPR News.